They feel insecure. They feel the country's being taken over. They don't say by whom, but by the pictures they show and the things they talk about, it's immigration and it's race and it's minorities.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
History professor Ruth Rosen has been teaching at the University of California system for 35 years. She taught the first courses in gender and society at UC Berkeley in the 70s. She has also had a career as an award-winning journalist, writing editorials and political columns for the Los Angeles Times and the San Francisco Chronicle. Wings interviewed Professor Rosen about the Tea Party phenomenon in U.S. politics and women's roles in this right-wing movement. We began by asking her opinion of Christine O'Donnell, a Tea Party favorite who surprisingly won the Republican nomination for U.S. Senator from Delaware over a veteran congressman.
She is completely unqualified to be a senator. I mean, it's ridiculous. She looks charming and pretty, but hey, those are qualities that don't matter for being a senator. The New York Times and other magazines and various online magazines have been documenting all the billionaires who are just dropping $500,000 on these candidates. So you get an unqualified pretty face and they become a really competitive power when there is a Tea Party movement. People are angry and they have a right to be angry. They have a right to be angry because they're jobless, they're really uncertain about their families, they're really concerned about ever being employed again or being employed at such a low level they can't live. The middle class has crashed and the poor have gotten even more impoverished. There's more homelessness, more homeless families who are even working but living in a car. So people are angry and disgruntled, but they will forget, because enough years have passed, that this was not Obama's doing, that this was the result of market fundamentalism. And turning a surplus into a huge debt with two gigantic wars that cost unbelievable, relentless billions of dollars every month, they will forget that the reason their kids don't have good schools or they don't have health care is because we are spending billions of dollars fighting wars rather than taking care of other people. So they're angry. And I don't blame them. They're insecure. Insecurity always historically breeds fear. Fear breeds the desire for a scapegoat. The scapegoat is either black or an immigrant in this case. They don't say it overtly, but if you look at their slogans, it's Take Back America. Well, from whom? We have a half-black president. I think part of this is a backlash against him. I teach the history of immigration, and you know, there have been cycles of really strong anti-immigration sentiment, and it's especially strong during periods of recession. Not that a lot of white working-class Americans want these jobs, but they just see a lot of people who are there illegally and are very, very upset about it. They fear that they're taking over the country. Take back America. And they're also afraid, because Obama has used the big bill, the stimulus bill, that that debt will add up to even a greater debt. I mean, what's strange is when the Republicans are in power, they create these enormous debts and put us into war or preparedness for war, and no one goes crazy about it. But when Democrats do that for health and welfare and to get the economy back on a good footing, people really fear tyranny, which is a deeply, deeply American tradition going back to the Revolution, the tyranny of the king and of centralized government. That's a really strong sentiment. And then, too, it's really important to remember that most immigrants, not all, but a lot of immigrants who come to the United States are also fleeing authoritarian governments of left or right persuasions. And so they, too, add to the deeply American distrust of centralized government and powerful government. So when Obama starts doing things, even though I may look at it as subsidies to the automobile industry or the financial industry or the housing industry or the banks, what they will see is a big government, and big government is something a lot of people fled as immigrants and came to the United States to escape from, to gain freedom. So they associate big government with tyranny. I mean, it's a powerful tradition, never to be underestimated. And the Tea Party movement has understood that much more I think, wisely than the Democrats have. The Democrats keep pushing for the big government without explaining why that's important and why it's not tyrannical. And they've got to address that because it is a genuine fear in American politics.
The Tea Party, though, and these conservative movements don't seem to fear the corporations. And there is such a tie now between government and corporation because of the campaign spending. Why don't they see that part of it?
That's such a wonderful question. I think the government is more visible. The corporation doesn't create your taxes. The corporation doesn't pave your roads or not pave them and leave them filled with potholes. The corporation doesn't decide whether you'll get welfare or how much or what will happen to universities, community colleges, and so forth. Those are all state decisions, municipal decisions, county decisions, or federal decisions. So the focus is always on the government because those are the people who are, in effect, implementing what is left of the pie for those things. You don't sit and think, the corporations are destroying the University of California or what used to be the number one public education system in the country, California, for example. No one would think that. But if they actually saw what kind of deficit California is running and why, and how it has passed it on to the counties and to the cities, a lot of what we are arguing for the pieces of and the crumbs for, we would understand this is the result of the federal government having been shrunken. As Grover Norquist said, I want the government to be so small it can go down the grain of a bathtub. Well, that is part of the agenda of the really serious right-wing conservatives in this country. And it's not necessarily the religious conservatives. It's really economic conservatives. What would that mean? You dismantle government and you have free market enterprise, which gives everyone an unregulated ability to make as much money as they want. And greed is very good. And if there are other people suffering, that really is their fault.
But there is, in fact, no free market once you get out of, let's say, the farmer's market level. Any economist will tell you free market means so many buyers and sellers that no one can influence the market. Free entry and exit into the marketplace for both buyers and sellers, just right there on those two grounds, you don't ever have a free market once you get above a certain level of complexity. Is it the media that is causing people who are Tea Partiers and are angry to not see these things?
The media, in a way, sometimes shapes opinion. But in this case, I think the Tea Party is not just a grassroots. I think it's that, and it is an invention of people who would profit from less regulation of many, many industries, especially the financial industry and banks. I mean, I think that there are people, as I said, who are angry and fearful and scared of lots of things. But they're not scared of corporations, and when they say make government smaller, they're afraid of tyranny, but they don't see the tyrannical impact of corporate policy. They only see a fear of a potential government kind of tyranny. So you're right, there is no real free market fundamentalism because the government, in fact, gives a lot of corporate welfare. In just the last year, we've seen all those subsidies that the government has given to financial industries and bailed them out. But who's bailing out the poor and who's bailing out the middle class and the people who've lost their homes? I mean, it's unbelievable that the government didn't first attack the foreclosure of homes and force banks to renegotiate with every single homeowner, unless they could prove they were speculator. But that should have been the very first thing, because people losing homes is a dreadful and horrifying thing. The Tea Party people aren't those people, though. Interestingly enough, the people who have lost their homes are staying with relatives, they're staying in motels, they're staying in their cars. Who are the Tea Partiers? Well, in my research, I found that they cross class lines. I was really surprised to find that there were more women involved than men. Those polls might be skewed because women may have more time to go to rallies and do the kind of work that women did in the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement and be the grassroots kind of worker who does what used to be the mimeographing, the equivalent of mimeographing and sending out messages. I found that there were lots of different kinds of women in the Tea Party. Some are really grassroots, frightened women who have created coffee klatches, and in a way, they've created a new women's movement for themselves. And they are not very loony, they're not very crazed, they are frightened, and they feel that the country's going in the wrong direction. Then there are women who love men who love guns, or women who love men who hate blacks, or women who love men who hate immigrants. And so they're just part of a culture and their husband's political beliefs. And then I think there are a lot of women who never had and were not allowed to have a serious role in the Republican Party. And they are using the Tea Party, which is to the right of what used to be called the moderate Republican Party, as a way to gain a voice in the Republican Party by making an end run. It's not an accident to me that there's so many successful female candidates in these recent flurry of the primaries. These women are using the Tea Party, some of them so unqualified, like Sarah Palin, inarticulate, not very knowledgeable about policy, not very knowledgeable about industry, international affairs, economy, politics, anything. And yet they are being elected. There's a famous historian who's no longer alive, Richard Hofstadter, who used to talk about the anti-intellectual and paranoid style in American politics and our fear of an elite. And they're so good, the party people, at saying that they're the grassroots people, when in fact some of them, like Sarah Palin, is becoming a gazillionaire. These people are very, very rich, and some of them are being given $500,000 here, $500,000 there by these backers of the Tea Party. And so they are able to do what George Bush did and say, hey, come on, let's go down and have a hamburger and a beer, which is ordinary folk. Well, the fact is you don't want ordinary folk legislating in the Senate. You really want wise, smart, really clever people who understand the unintended consequences of policy and the difficulty of policies and so forth. You just look at the health care bill. I mean, it was so complicated. And you don't want ordinary folks, I wouldn't want to be legislating health care unless it was a single payer and it was very simple. After that, I wouldn't know what to do. So I think it's easier to believe that these women really are the ordinary folk, don't know that much, and therefore are in some ways just glamorous representations of ordinary people. And the fact that they're all white helps. I really do think there's a serious backlash against Obama. And I think he will be blamed for the wars. I won't get into all the things he could have done and things I'm disappointed in that he hasn't done. But I think he will be blamed for things that he did not start, which is a profound recession. I think it's a depression, a really serious depression that's on the edge of a cliff. And two wars that are not successful and that we cannot win and won't win, haven't won. As a historian, I know too much about those countries to think that we could even slightly win. So I think he will be blamed. And since the Republicans were relatively helpless, except that they could create gridlock, that was their strength, that they could threaten all the time filibusters, I think that the Democrats, with their spineless backs, never took them up on it. I would have loved to have seen 48 days go by and watch Republicans read from the telephone book, like I saw Southern Dixiecrats do during the Civil Rights Movement, but that isn't happening. So I'm very concerned about this Tea Party movement. I think the question a historian would ask, looking back, would I see this as a transient fad that will last a few years, like the Know-Nothing Party in the 19th century? Or is this a serious takeover of the Republican Party? Or is the Republican Party going to co-opt this and people will take more moderate stance once they get into office? That has been the tradition in America. Even when radical leftists or radical rightists have gotten into office, or on the Supreme Court for that matter, they've modulated their positions and people have always moved more to the center, almost always, not predictably, but more often than I would have ever guessed. But I don't know what this is. I take it seriously. I think it's a threat. It has an undercurrent and a subterranean threat of violence, and that scares me. Because when people say, what should we do? And you hear someone say, well, reload. I mean, they're talking about guns. I see, you know, a subterranean threat here, not all the Tea Party, but there's some groups in there that I've looked in their websites. They are militias, and they mean to either get elected and win electorally or buy the gun. And they say that on their website. That scares me.
Now, will the fact that the Tea Party has a majority of women be a moderation of that possible violent factor, or are the women threatening more violence?
You know, that's a really good question, which I'm not sure. when Sarah Palin uses all this metaphorical language about guns and let's reload and so forth, and when some of the women use that, I think they're almost like the women who are in the Weathermen. They're trying to be as macho as the men in the movement. I don't know how much they would modulate it or whether they are trying to fit in. I can't tell. I don't know whether Sarah Palin wants to encourage violence. Her language does. It's inciting. A long time ago, people were actually indicted for that kind of incitement, for using that language when they were on the left. So it's a scary language, whatever direction it comes from. I would never seek social change through violence. And it bothers me that there are these women who really are in love with men who love guns, who would pick up a gun. And that there are these militias whose statements about we'll win one way or another through elections or guns. I take that seriously. Will women modulate it? Who knows? I've never been a believer, though I've been a feminist since 1967, that women are morally superior or more peaceful than men. I think in the majority, women haven't had the opportunity to be as violent as men, and so I don't think they will be. But when women get into leadership roles, as opposed to ordinary women's lives, then they can adopt, and are expected to adopt, which I think Hillary Clinton would have adopted, more militant, hawkish views, like Golda Meir or Indira Gandhi, or Margaret Thatcher. When women get to the really high national level, they often adopt even a more hawkish and a more militant voice than men do. Ordinary women in general don't, and they make up most of the rank and file of the anti-war groups in world history. And yet they've supported lots of horrible things. There were lots of women in the Nazi Party, and there were lots of women who went along with all kinds of things that were horrible in China and in Soviet Union. But in general, I think women have had, if you look at their history, a more peaceful history, but not the leaders of countries, not those women who get to be where men are. And that was actually one of my concerns for Hillary Clinton, that she would feel urged and forced, perhaps, to adopt a more militaristic, I'm more violent than thou kind of rhetoric to prove that she could be as tough as any man. And I felt, actually, that Obama, on the opposite side, being a black man, would feel restrained to be violent because Americans are terrified of angry black men. And so in some ways, I thought Obama was a safer bet in terms of violence. That was just my hypothesis from what I've seen of women leaders of countries.
Now, we also have the really radical right Christian movement. And how is that going to influence?
The women in the right-wing movement, it's weird. This is a group of women who, in fact, are working women, who admire Sarah Palin for having a lot of children and still speaking up and being a strong woman. And they call it the new Christian right-wing feminism. And they say, we're taking over the movement, the women's movement. We think it's fine for women to work out of the house. Well, one of the things they're going to discover as they work out of the house is, who's going to take care of the children? It's like question number 101. And then the question is, will they get equal pay? And if they don't, their family may not survive very well. So they will encounter the exact same issues that the original women's movement raised in the second wave in the late 60s. Child care, probably health care, equal pay, promotion, retention. I mean, they will see injustices toward themselves. And I think they'll be irritated by it. So the very fact that more of those women are entering the labor force is actually counter to their ideology. What's going to happen with that? I don't know, but it's a contradiction and it's a paradox that we ought to look at. Now, some women are still stay-at-home moms of all classes, some who, because they can just afford it, but are very liberal, and some who are very conservative. But in the very poorer ranks, there are also very religious right-wing women who are at work because their families need two incomes. And it's hard to say I should be in a submissive position when I bring home a paycheck. What is the proper role for women in the modern society is happening all over the globe. As women enter the labor force and they get more education, they start seeking to limit their families, to have fewer children. They seek promotion. Their horizons are broadened by being educated. And so whatever conservative attitudes they were brought up with are implicitly challenged by the world they enter. And that is what is going to happen this century. Women all over the globe are going to enter some kind of labor force. And that paradox between the traditional customs, which some of which are crimes, and women's entry into the labor force and the spread of reproductive choices, whether legal or not, is going to create a very complicated, I think, cultural war all over the world.
Why all this culture war stuff. I mean, I think of war and peace. I think of the economy. Those are vital things for everyone. And yet the conservatives want to bring up this culture war. Why don't we just leave people to be people, and then you have your culture, I have mine, but the point is, should we pay taxes toward war? Should we have a jobs program? Should we have single-payer health care, etc.? What's in it for the conservatives to bring up this culture war stuff?
As a historian, the way I teach the answer to that really profound question, why have we had what's equivalent to almost 40 years of culture wars? I believe it's because in the 1960s, various groups challenged received wisdom. First, we challenged the idea that one race is superior to another. Then we challenged the belief that one group of people, namely men, are naturally superior to women. Then we challenged the government about whether it was telling the truth and whether it had the right to get involved in a war that, in fact, was based on lies. Then we challenge the rapacious nature of how we deal with nature with the environmental movement. Then we challenge the received wisdom about sexuality and said people's sexuality and their orientation are up to them and it's nobody's business. And I ask you to consider just those, there's more, but by 1971, all those things had been challenged. That's talking about sexuality, about gender relations, about race relations. And we question war and we question the truthfulness of our government. That is so profound. So I have really believed that we have been debating the 60s since the 70s. And the biggest thing that plopped on the screen, the radar screen, was 1973. When abortion was made legal, I remember very clearly just standing there and saying to myself, oh my goodness, this is going to polarize this country for 40 years. I wish it had come through Congress rather than a decision from the Supreme Court. There would have been a long debate in the country, and we would have had our representatives pass this as France did rather than a Supreme Court decision. Because the culture war began, actually, interestingly enough, over child care. That was the first moment in 1970, the Senate and the Congress passed a bill for comprehensive child care. And that's when the first culture war began. I mean, besides civil rights, of course, and the anti-war movement and the women's movement, but what we would call culture wars, the backlash. I don't think you could get a bill like that passed today. And Richard Nixon vetoed it, saying, we don't want our women to be like Soviet women. We want women to be home and be pretty when their men come home. We don't want to Sovietize. Women should take care of their own children. That is the last time childcare ever rose to the level of the national agenda. Abortion certainly has stayed there. Gay rights have stayed there. Gay marriage has stayed there. What constitutes a family has stayed there. The rights of working women have stayed there, but not childcare. It's off the radar. It's off the agenda. The next thing was just 3 years later, 1973, when Roe v. Wade was passed. That immediately brought in gazillion dollars from the Sloan Foundation, from Coors Beer, all kinds of foundations to create a pro-life movement. I think from then on, of course, Ronald Reagan was extremely effective because he was charming and twinkling and had a very good rapport with the American public. He was very able to convince and persuade the American public that the real America was in the 1950s, which was actually pretty aberrant and abnormal. And if you actually looked at it, had to do with prosperity of women going to work during the 50s more than anything that gave rise to widespread middle class prosperity, because women started going to work when their children were in junior high or high school. And economists know this. Lots of economists know this. And so I think Ronald Reagan continued it. And then, it really became fierce in the universities, the culture wars, about what should we study, because the movements to study groups that had been forgotten, not thought about, never written about, like all the minorities in America, Native Americans and slaves and post-slavery reconstruction and blacks after that, women throughout all of American history and throughout the whole world. This is a lot of history and literature that was introduced into the curriculum. That has made people on the right feel like, wait a minute, they're taking over the country. So this sense of being taken over, it's not new. It's a very powerful slogan, and it resonates very strongly in the Tea Party, and it is their main slogan. But it's been going on for 40 years. And just when I thought the culture wars might be taking a dip, well, they're revving up, and they're really white hot again. And the interesting thing is it's very incoherent now. because it's not like we don't want to read Toni Morrison in the English department, or we don't want to have any kind of studies about disabilities or about gays and lesbians, or we don't want to read about women all over the world. No, it's more incoherent than that. When you look at the websites, particularly I looked at the women's websites who are part of the movement of the Tea Party, I couldn't replicate a coherent ideology for you. I can only say they are afraid. They feel insecure. They feel the country's being taken over. They don't say by whom, but by the pictures they show and the things they talk about, it's immigration and it's race and it's minorities. And so people can start thinking, wait a minute, you know, my country is a white Protestant America. We've already allowed all these Catholics in. We've already allowed all these Jews in. Now we've let in all these Hindus and Buddhists. And now we're letting in all these Muslims, the last group, really, of immigration. So they've become the most current scapegoat. But they don't really articulate that because they don't want to be called racist. And George Bush actually wasn't a racist. I never found any evidence for that. I mean, he really did want to dismantle government. There's no question about that. But he didn't use the language of the Tea Party, of take back America. It's a passionate plea. Take back America. It's gone wrong. It's going in the wrong direction. And I have to say, I do think part of it is a backlash against having a black president. I do think that measures in to what degree, it's hard to say. The metaphors they use are not about blackness, interestingly enough, but about Hitler. I've never seen so many references to Hitler in my entire life, except during the first 10 years, maybe after the Holocaust. So it's a very weird time. I don't think a coherent answer is possible because I don't think they provide one. I do think it's important to see the emotions behind language, though. I see fear. I see insecurity. And that's what happened in the Weimar Republic. People really were poor and really getting poorer at the end of the Weimar Republic. I think people are insecure, and I think it's terrifying to not know whether you're going to keep your job and keep your home. Those are very basic American values, to want to have job security. I once wrote an article that people liked because it was called Talking Taxes. What I basically was arguing was that social contract theory in the Enlightenment meant that people come together so that they're not barbarians and they don't kill each other, and they make a contract to help each other. One of the first things that people do, say, in a frontier town is they create a fire brigade to help each other in case a fire breaks out. The second thing they do is they create some kind of law enforcement so that people don't kill each other and don't destroy each other or harm other people. The third thing they might do is, if they want to have roads or schools, is they start beginning to tax each other in order to get the revenue to build those public institutions, because they're public. That's where the origin of taxes come. It's public revenue for a public common good. The idea of a common good is so alien to Americans because we have the most individualistic society in the world. And there are positive aspects of that, which have helped women liberate themselves from constraints of family life. The negative parts are that we have lost the ability to take care of each other, and we've lost the ability to think that that's even a really good idea. And so we don't have a compassionate society.
That was UC Berkeley visiting history professor Ruth Rosen. She has written many books, including The World Split Open: How the Modern Women's Movement Changed America. She has also had a career as an award-winning journalist, writing editorials and political columns for the Los Angeles Times and the San Francisco Chronicle. For Wings, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
To hear this program again, email wings@wings.org. Thanks to our Wings supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.